I really appreciate being invited to this symposium, but I will admit freely that I am not a biogeochemist, which I'm sure that you will suspect very shortly in this talk. But what I think I really share with the group is a real interest in spatial patterns and in the functions of wetlands. And I think I can speak to that in the Bald Cypress Swamp region of the southeastern United States. I chose this area for a lot of reasons, but I wanted to get a large geographical area in which to set up a network where the conditions would be varying mostly by temperature. And I know that's not exactly true, but I wanted to look at this in terms of a climate change question, to look at things like production and other functional patterns to see how they changed across this geographical range, and then make predictions about climate change. Another advantage to the Bald Cypress Swamp region is that we don't have to be really, really cold in August. Like I get cold watching the pictures of you guys working in northern Minnesota and Michigan, but it's all on one continent. It's in the far southeast. And it's also dominated by one or two species. And as some of the discussions have gone already today, it is the dominants are actually very important in how the systems function. So most of these are the study swamps that I chose are dominated by Taxodium distichum, which is the bald cypress. I'm going to see if I can do something there we go, a pointer. The Bald Cypress Swamp region set up, the network that I've been working in, is started off, oh, that is not going to work. Okay, you're just going to have to look at this. Okay, I started the project by setting up a network of five replicated swamps along the Mississippi River alluvial valley from southern Illinois to the middle part of Louisiana. And there's just no pointer. This is quite frustrating. Well, anyway. All right, so that was the original part of the study, and that's what I'm going to talk about mostly today, because I'm going to talk about organic matter storage properties across that range and then relate it to production patterns. But I'm going to talk about the green areas that you see along the Gulf Coast of the U.S., from Texas to Florida, and talk about the organic matter storage there as well. And these are, for those of you that don't know, are also peatlands. Okay, now we're going to get some of you interested, because they store great amounts of peat. Not so much the Mississippi River alluvial valley, but that is the setup. Now, as I started this project in about 2004, I looked through the literature and looked at the patterns of production, and I looked at soil organic matter, above ground litter production, and root production. And what I was expecting to find was a linear pattern looking at latitude and then biomass across the latitude, starting in the south, okay, which is down by 26 here, and I was expecting that it would be very high in the south and then decrease as you went northward to southern Illinois. And that's just based on the older models that are published. But what I found instead was a curvilinear model where the production levels were highest in the center of the range and then lower to the north and the south. And that was based on a small amount of data that I collected, plus looking at the literature. I got really intrigued by that, and I wanted to find out if I collected the data myself in this huge drive-by biology project that I showed you, that I would be able to recreate these same patterns. And one of the things that Randy Kolka asked me if I would talk about today were the organic matter storage properties of the swamps that are along the Mississippi River alluvial valley. And so then in looking at the lineup of the amount of organic matter in these areas that I collected the organic matter myself, from southern Illinois to the central part of Louisiana, you can see, this is not a picture that I took in the field, but I lined them all up using photographic techniques. So Deer Pond, Illinois, south to Rainy Lake, Louisiana, you'll see, just looking at the soil cores taken with the Russian peat core, that Goose Lake, Arkansas, which is in the center of the range, has the highest amount of organic matter at the top of the soil core, if you can see that in these samples. And I'll show you a bit more of that in a minute. Okay, so as we look at the percent organic matter across the latitudes, we found, using our own collected data, this same curvilinear pattern. So, and this was also, I divided this into three different depths using the Russian peat core information, 10 centimeters, then to 20 centimeters, and then 30 to 50 centimeters. And the highest organic matter was in the center of the range, and it was lower to the south in Louisiana and lower in southern Illinois. So that was the pattern I was expecting based on the prediction from the production values that I showed you. And I also thought it would be fun just to show you what the soil looks like. I know most of you probably work farther north than this, but there's a lot of clay in these swamps, and you can see that kind of bluish-gray material that are not my boots, are the lower layers from up to about 50 centimeters, and then the top layers are where the organic matter is stored. All right, so I at some point hope to put this all into a giant carbon storage model using all of these factors, but what I actually thought might be more interesting to talk about today was how production relates to the organic matter storage. And I think there's a strong relationship with this. And along with looking at the soil organic matter, we've also, across this geographical gradient, we've also been doing things like collecting leaf litter, wood production, and then also looking at root ingrowth bags to get the annual rate of root production on a yearly basis. So this is in all of these places I showed you. At each of these 70 sites, we have five production plots and where we do root and leaf litter samples. So there's a lot of samples and a lot of driving. And what I found, and I was not surprised, but I was happy, but the original prediction based on the model from the literature was that the amounts of production from the roots and the leaf litter and the organic matter would be curvilinear, and using our own data collected in the field, we found the same pattern. Now, maybe that doesn't seem like a big deal to you, but sometimes I don't really believe things unless they're all done the same way and I do them myself. And so I'm now convinced that that's actually how it works. And so the interesting thing about this is that if we know that the production patterns are highest in the center of the range, then as the climates get warmer with climate change, then what do we expect? And I know several of you talked about how it isn't just temperature, and I'm convinced of the same thing. But according to the model that we first put together when we were talking about this, was if we were to increase the temperature as IPCC suggested by 1.3 and 3.5 degrees centigrade, what would happen to the production levels of the swamps that are at the edge of the range? For example, Texas. And so it predicts that the production levels would go down. All right, I was happy with that at the time I did this. Well, so now we're working in Texas, and we got the big drought of 2012. And I think I found now that water trumps everything, because when there was no water and high salinity on the coast, the trees began to die. So it wasn't a matter of it getting hotter and the production levels getting lower because, you know, the trees were respiring more quickly or something like that. It was more of a matter of the trees did not have enough water and they began to die. So I think in the climate change of the future that I see. I see the edges of the Cypress Swamp Range beginning to retract toward Arkansas and moving northward to places like Illinois. This is how you tell a dead tree. You guys are agronomists, I guess, so this isn't going to be surprising to you. You know a dying plant when you see one, probably. So we're on the same page with this. All right, so now I've been talking to you about what's happening across the Mississippi River alluvial valley. All right, and so that's from about 37 to 27 degrees north latitude. Well, I also wanted to talk to you about these peatlands that I referred to in the beginning. And so these are the swamps that I've been working on across the Gulf Coast. And, all right, change of gears. All right, after one of the things that's been happening is since I have these long-term swamp studies is that something will happen to the area. For example, the Gulf oil spill. All right, there was a huge problem in Louisiana. The oil was coming. The state of Louisiana opened the Mississippi River to six times its normal amount of discharge. Again, making me think that water could be a big deal in this whole equation. And they completely changed my hydrologically altered swamps by freshening the water, lowering the salinity. I would go out there and I actually smelled the trees growing better that year. And so I was like, what would happen to the organic matter storage in this particular year? And I don't think I really told Randy I was going to talk about this, but as I started thinking about what I knew about peat storage, I thought this was probably the most exciting story that I had to say. Because if you actually restore the natural hydrology in the case of Louisiana, these swamps have been cut off from the Mississippi River for a number of years, what happens? And so we did very detailed water analysis, and this was the simplest way that I could put what went on. We have water level recorders out in the swamps on the coast in Louisiana. And in 2010, which is the blue line and where it says water level, it's the blue line on the top, you can see that in the between May and about September, the water levels are really high when they're generally really low. And the black line is a combination, a mean of 2008, 9, and 11, which in the grand scheme of things were fairly wet years. We compared it to wet years, we compared it to dry years, we compared it to longer term mean of 10 years, just to see if 2010 was always different. It was always different, with six times the amount of water being discharged from the Mississippi River. And the other thing that happened is if you see below in the red line, this shows you the salinity levels. The salinity levels went down. Now, as biogeochemistry people, you probably know that a whole lot of things changed when the salinity went down. You had fresh, flowing, colder water. At any rate, the trees really like this. I mean, if I can say that in a scientific sense. But the thing about it is that if the trees are growing well, they also produce a lot of organic matter. So that's where things get exciting. And we had, as we do in all of the plots, we have root ingrowth cores, floating leaf litter traps, and then also dendrometer bands to look at the tree growth. And what we found for the growth in the long-term sense from 2007 to 2011, remember that 2010 was the year of the hydrologic remediation. The trees, the leaf litter, and the root wood production that particular year in 2010 went up by almost three times. So the trees were growing really well, and that continued into 2011. The root growth, on the other hand, went down. That surprised me when I first saw that, but I know from doing experiments that when you give the plants a condition that they grow really well in on the top, sometimes what they're doing is translocating materials from the roots to grow more material in the upper part of the plant. So I think that's what was happening. And then by 2011, those levels went up again. That is an important thing because in 2011, okay, now these are subsiding swamps in Louisiana, the elevation of these swamps went up that year too. So what about the peat elevation? I think I'm just going to move past this. It also depends on decomposition, of course. I know that we did not have any decomposition bags in the field in 2010. So I think rather than try to torturously go into why I think there was decomposition was not a big factor in this with very little data, I will just move past that and talk about the sediment elevation. The sediment elevation in 2010 went up. And let me show you what was happening. I told you these are subsiding swamps. The peat in these areas was not building up. It was the elevations were declining. So between 2007 and 2010, again, when the root production was really low, the absolute elevation of these four SETs that we have, you know what sediment elevation tables are? Yeah, they're stable monuments. The elevations at those sites were decreasing, and then after 2010, from 2011 to 2014, there was what is called in ecology an ecological regime shift. The elevations in the sites went up dramatically. So that was really exciting. It likely means something in terms of how we actually manage the water in Louisiana. I think we need to supply the swamps with conditions where they are actually well adapted to the situation, but they've been hydrologically altered for a long time. These are just the statistics of the piecewise regression. I guess you'll just, you know, when the paper comes out, you'll take a close look at that. So organic matter production contributes to elevation. It's a matter of organic matter storage based on how much is produced and also how much is broken down by decomposition. So when you have a situation where the plants are growing tremendously well, they will produce more organic matter. And I think in the case, the second case that I was showing you about the Gulf Coast, when you improve the conditions, you freshen the water, and you give the trees a situation that they are well adapted to. They grow better than they do in a hydrologically altered situation. And in the case of the Mississippi River Alluvial Valley, the trees are growing the best in Arkansas because it's the middle of the range, and that's also where you have the highest organic matter storage. So, my apologies about my lack of my biogeochemical details, but you know, I can tell you all about production and geography. So and I have lots of helpers.
Great, we have time for questions.
On organic matter, is this carbon that you're talking about here? This is what you...
Right, this is we did that using loss on ignition, and so we burn the whole, you know, the whole sample and then determine what the percent of carbon is.
LOI then, what you're presenting, or did you run carbon both, loss on ignition and carbon, or... Just get a feeling for organic matter, because lots of times organic matter and carbon are used synonymously.
It was organic matter, strictly what was burned off in the weight of the loss. Mm-hmm. Carl?
Beth, what was the water table doing on the last piece there where you were showing a rise in surface elevation after 2010?
We do have water level recorders. In 2011, the water levels were also fairly high. So 2010 was a high water year when the elevations were the lowest. 2011 were high but not as high as 2010, and then in the following years the water levels were lower. So the water didn't really seem to be part of what was happening with that peat mass. And also the way these sediment elevation tables are measured, and you're probably familiar with that with lowering the pins, it really doesn't matter so much how they're floating. It matters when you get to that careful level, that careful point of resistance. All of those were measured by the same person, which I also think is an important thing, because the floating peat is tremendously tricky to measure.
When the elevation goes up, does the density go down or is the density constant?
So the density of the peat?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I know that's an important question, but I guess one of the things is with the set measurements and lowering the pins, the idea is that you're lowering it until you reach that point where it doesn't really lower very well anymore. So the idea is that you're hitting that same density level, and that's why it's important to have the same person measure them.